You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, February 22nd, the Will Porn Be Banned in the Matriarchy edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. In the New York studios, we have June Thomas, a managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
Before we get started today, I just want to thank you for all your skincare tips and suggestions. There were people, listeners, throwing out like tips for June because she's not into skincare and just like sisterly patting Noreen on the back, like, you don't have to wash your face. It's totally good. It was amazing. And then we had one listener who was like, this is the most boring segment that I've ever heard. But most of you were really into skincare, so thank you for sharing. Didn't you guys appreciate getting little tips in your inbox every day from our listeners?
I did, and I also didn't mind being nagged either, because I think, okay, yeah, keep treat us mean, keep us keen, yeah.
Exactly. Oh, British expressions. Okay, so our three topics today. First, the latest abuse scandal at the White House. Second, boys and porn. And finally, Lena Dunham writes about her hysterectomy. We reluctantly discuss. And for our Slate Plus segment, June, do you want to lead us in?
Yes. Very exciting Slate Plus segment this week, which is whether ladies figure skating is sexist. If you want to hear that segment and get all of the great extras that Slate Plus members get while they are supporting Slate's journalism, sign up for a 2-week free trial at slate.com/XX+.
All right. Our first topic, the abuse scandal at the White House. Wow, it's just coming fast and for a long time, this one. First, its staff secretary, Rob Porter, resigns after it's discovered that he'd been accused by two of his ex-wives of domestic abuse. And that the White House, or at least the White House chief of staff, probably knew about it months ago. Then it looked like a speechwriter also had the same issue and wasn't getting his security clearance. Then it's discovered that Trump's lawyer paid a porn actress hush money to cover up the affair with Trump. So I'm sure you guys are with me. It's not like it's totally surprising and you were like, OMG, I can't believe this kind of thing happened at the White House. But what is kind of alarming and different is that there is this whole infrastructure working to cover up bad behavior and sweep it under the rug. And so it feels different. And I feel like the Republicans are responding to it in a different way. So let's talk about that. First is, like, the one thing that I noticed that was unusual was just how long it lasted. Like, Rob Porter resigned a few days ago, and the scandal just keeps going and going. Do you guys have a theory about why this one seems to have lasted longer than others?
I mean, I think clearly there are several factors. Partly it's that there was, I think maybe people are just expecting constantly that there will be limits about how sort of casual the Trump administration is about certain things like domestic abuse, domestic violence. It's, as you say, it's not entirely surprising that it's taken Trump so long to make any kind of statement about it. We really shouldn't be surprised when the man himself, you know, does something or doesn't do something like that, because that's, you know, that's how he is. That's how he got. That's how he was when he got elected. I don't really expect him to change. But this is something like you always think there've got to be limits. There've got to be things that you can't just go along with. And the fact that John Kelly, who was, you know, supposed to be, you know, this the adult in the room, you know, a general who's, you know, a man of honor and all of that, apparently knew about the allegations against Porter, kind of lied about them, you know, really, you know, I guess you could say, gave up his honor for this guy who, you know, it's clearly not worth it. It's a very, like, I think it's all about finding how far they'll go down this path of just messing with all the norms and just ignoring the standards of behavior that I think we'd all signed on to.
Yeah, I think it's a few things. I think one, it's that Kelly was supposed to be the guy bringing order to the White House, right? Like, Steve Bannon is out, the chaos agent, who himself, by the way, has a history of domestic abuse, alleged domestic abuse, is out.
As does Trump, by the way. And Trump. We'll get to that.
It's a real wonderful assemblage of men that he's surrounded himself with. So I think that's one part of it. Just the idea that, like, even the guy brought in to clean this mess up is willing to cover up for domestic abusers if they are good at making the trains run on time. And two, I think it's like the visceralness of the image. Yeah. You know, there was this really upsetting image of Rob Porter's first wife, I believe, with a black eye after she says he'd hit her. And that was everywhere. And I think that's difficult for people to ignore. I think some of the people who might look at some of the allegations against Trump, for instance, and say, oh, he just kissed her. Oh, you can't prove that. Oh, whatever. Like, when you see, you know, this visceral image, that's a little harder to dismiss. But I guess I'm not sure that Republicans have actually reacted differently. I'm interested in that statement, Hannah.
Well, yes. I mean, I think part of it is what you said, the picture and the fact that, you know, post hashtag Me Too, a kind of story rises to the top that didn't used to in all of its details, like the details of the early, you know, years of his Mormon marriage, you know, the particular ways that he was violent. It's a very realistic image of a domestic abuser, and we can hear it now because we make spaces for details in women's stories in a way that we didn't. You know, there used to be a kind of cultural resistance to the particularities of an abuse story, and now there isn't. And so I think it's extremely relatable. Like, I think a lot of people who have suffered domestic violence, been in abusive marriages, will hear these details and identify with them. And I don't know, that was part of my theory of why that's one idea about why Republicans would be responsive, just because of the white woman problem. Like, there actually is a lot of slippage in the February polls of working class white women supporting Republicans. And I think a story like this, you know, people hear it, people identify with it. It's not like we now even receive him as just kind of a blank monster. Like, the story is very believable. He's a charming guy. He has these qualities. This is a Mormon marriage. He was constrained. The first day he pushed me down on the bed and he put his knee. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a story. It's a story. It's a real story. It started in the Daily Mail, but it's like, it's kind of picked up details and steam along the way that I think, you know, women will read and kind of it will stick in their heads in a way that I think scares the Republicans. I mean, that's the cynical explanation for why, like, Trey Gowdy and Paul Ryan
and Mike Pence weren't,
you know, totally, they were silent for like a minute. You know, there was like the Orrin Hatch moment where it was like, you know, we back, he's a good guy. You know, that bullshit when they're like, he's a good guy, as if like that's his wife said he's a good guy. He also just has an anger problem, you know? So there was that stupid retrograde second, but then everybody else was like, no, you know?
It was really interesting to me when Trey Gowdy got in, you know, the Benghazi guy, you know, this is not a moderate Republican. And he, you know, said that his House Oversight Committee was going to launch an investigation specifically into this matter of security clearances, because one of the things that kind of came out of all of this stuff that's going on in the White House is that so many people are operating on interim security clearances because they have failed to get a security clearance, that when the FBI investigates them, they find these serious problems, you know, serious problems that they don't feel they can approve a security clearance. And yet they continue to be in the White House on an interim security clearance. And like, that cannot be. And so it's interesting that we take this security angle. And yeah, Trey Gowdy, you know, did say, and these are accusations of domestic violence. You know, it wasn't that he was, you know, didn't mention that to give him credit, but it's also this other, you know, it's not a womanly problem. It's like, well, then we have security problems.
Right.
Which do seem completely unacceptable.
Which are, you know, the idea that someone would be theoretically open to, like, maybe blackmail, for instance,
exactly,
if they have these skeletons in their closet. It's not like this is about the FBI cares necessarily about the deep moral character and the way these people treat women. It's more like.
But it's not just a security clearance problem. It's an anger management problem.
Well,
like, you know, domestic violence is like a tricky one in the workplace because you can fire anyone for any reason anyway, but in general, there is like a robust legal discussion about whether if someone's accused of domestic violence, you should fire that person. And a lot of the legal advice is about, you know, you are essentially liable for putting your employees at risk. If you harbor someone who you know has a volatile temper and explosive anger. So partly it's can he be blackmailed? He's dating someone in the White House.
No.
Like, you can see the problem a year down the road. Like, his girlfriend is Hope Hicks.
According to the Daily Mail.
Okay, X. But, like, so it's not that hard if you play this out a year or two. Like, it could create a lot of problems for the White House and a lot of problems of sort of intimidation of your employees. Like, it's a tricky one, having someone who has a domestic abuse problem as an employer,
but
who's
not
convicted.
Yeah, I mean, and that's another area. I mean, I think that is why this is so rich, that there are so many aspects to it, that someone can say this security clearance is an issue when I think we all would agree that's not exactly the issue. This whole thing of alleged accused, that allowed Trump to go on one of his Twitter rants where he talked about, you know, due process and the accusations, and which, you know, in other areas, yes, I do believe in due process. But as you say, this is a slightly different situation because of what it says about these people who are, you know, against whom very reasonable and credible accusations have been made, and what it means to put them in close contact with your employees.
Yeah. I mean, the boss's attitude towards this whole thing is really telling. And, you know, I realize that the Trump administration was not exactly selecting from the cream of the crop of Republicans. There were a lot of people who wouldn't work for the administration, and a lot of people they wouldn't hire because they'd said bad things about them. But it really does seem like there's a whole set of personality traits that seem to have either been self-selected or selected for when they were doing the hiring for the White House. And, you know, it's a sort of aggressive, amoral kind of guy who seems to have gravitated towards working with Trump. And wonder what that's about.
And the women who love them.
And the women who love them. I mean, there are some days when I feel like the quality they select for is like how much can you stoke a gender war? Like, how much can you just whip up the man? It does feel that way sometimes. Like, Steve Bannon was talking about, you know, the end of patriarchy, like all these women and their complaints coming to the fore. And we've talked about the manosphere and sort of the attitudes of the manosphere on this show. And I want to say that in the 1993 book about Trump, which was written by a Texas Monthly Newsweek reporter, his first wife said he raped her, and it was in a deposition. Like, he does have, over a completely, like, vain and stupid thing, it's a story that's so ridiculous that you can't even, you know, it's like the worst of Trump. Like, it has to do with, like, her doctor messing up his hair transplant or something like that. It's a ridiculous story. But anyway, that he raped her for that reason. So develops this, like, big picture of exactly what you guys said, like, people who just don't care. Now the question is, does this actually change anything? Like, does it at what or around the edges, like, what could shift in the view of Trump? Is it more scary? Like, it's, you can sort of laugh and, like, watch the big man say his stupid things, as my mom does, and kind of excuse it. But do you guys think it's just kind of more scary when it feels like a kind of systemic chaos, misogyny? Like, does that freak people out more?
I mean, it's freaked me out since the first minute of the first debate. I mean, the first Republican debate, when essentially Trump called a woman a fat pig and, you know, then made a specific comment about Rosie O'Donnell. I mean, in some ways that's silly, but really fundamentally it shows his values, and they're appalling. It's a total lack of values, and the fact that people voted for that is appalling. It's clear that that is, why would that not be the mood in the White House? Why would that not be the values? Why would they care about truth when the man just tells lies just every time he opens his mouth? How could things be different from how they are, given who he is and the fact that he's the president? But I do every minute of every day of this administration. I wonder when we're going to come to our senses, but I wonder if we will.
Well, Steve Bannon and I agree that the patriarchy is over and the matriarchy is coming in. And I'm sort of serious. Like, I actually think that they are, you know, just exposing the grossness of the system in a way that all of our, like, feminist careful talking about or complaining could never do. And they are just, like, really exposing it to be corrupt. So many people, obviously, you know, outside this group that has a lot of power are sort of getting woke to this as a result of this. And, you know, the matriarchy, it's on its way. But, okay, one other thing about this situation that I just want to flag. The Washington Post had an article that I found really stunning in its heartlessness, not the article itself, but the administration officials who were quoted. They were quoted saying that the school shooting in Florida gave them a reprieve from, you know, this bad press. And this actual White House official said on the record, a lot of people here felt like it was a reprieve from 7 or 8 days of just getting pummeled. Like, they just are so dissociated from, frankly, like, normal human feelings that they were relieved that their domestic abuse scandal could go away from the headlines for a few days because a bunch of children were murdered. Like, that's really bad.
That's so funny because that is such, like, deep in Washington analysis.
Oh.
I read that story and, like, sort of underneath my consciousness, I was like, there's something wrong with this story. But because I've lived in Washington too long, like, I couldn't quite grasp it the way people outside. It's just not normal.
Oh, no.
Like, that whole way of thinking is just so fucked up. It's just not normal.
It's
but I didn't
so
quite
fucked up.
Put my finger on it. Oh, my
Hannah,
God.
Hannah, do you think the matriarchy's coming?
You know me. Do I think the matriarchy is coming? I think a certain... I got in so much trouble once for writing stories saying the patriarchy is dead. Can I amend that and say, like, a certain kind of just, like, louche, dilapidated patriarchy is being toppled, you know?
The patriarchy is acting out.
I will sign on with you that the matriarchy is coming when the hashtag MeToo reaches, like, Wall Street and just kind of centers of American power having to do with money and technology, mm-hmm. and the future in a more real way, then I'll say the matriarchy is coming. But for now, I'll say that, like, you know, a certain foundation of the patriarchy is crumbling. I'll put it at that.
I'll take it.
Okay, we'll take it. Patriarchy crumbling, corners of the edifice eradicated, shot down.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, boys and porn. Recently, the New York Times published a cover story called What Teenagers Are Learning from Online Porn. This is something we all kind of know, that there's a ton of online porn. It's all free, and the teenagers are definitely looking at it. But for me, at least, the story forced more than any other, kind of forced me not to look away from something I sort of know but don't want to fully digest, that almost all teens watch online porn. There was really just statistics in there about that, and that they're using it as a kind of visual dictionary of sexual practices. Oh, I am very interested to talk about this topic because I have lots of fights with my friends about it. Mm. The first thing I want to put out there is there was a kind of crushing innocence to the quotes in this story. She interviewed lots of people in what was called a porn literacy class. And it wasn't your usual, like,
like sort of swaggering guys. Like I've interviewed the swaggering young guys myself who watch porn. This was a kind of stumbling towards understanding vibe that these boys had, which I think is why this article affected me more than many that I've read about online porn, because it felt like they were trying to figure things out. And so you could almost watch the porn kind of making its way through their young, unformed imaginations more than in most stories, which capture just the like swagger, as I said. So one guy says, "I would just do it," said another boy in jeans and a sweatshirt. When I asked what he meant, he said anal sex. He assumed that girls like it because the women in porn do. All right. So do you guys read stories like this and kind of take them really, do you feel alarmed and take them really seriously? Or do you have the feeling that maybe boys or girls watching online porn are kind of smarter than we give them credit for? That's the line that I, that's one of the lines I play with in my head.
I think both. I mean, I should say that I know very few teenagers. So this probably I'm reading these stories and using my imagination rather than relating them to real human beings that I know. But I do have faith that people, not only kids who are going to porn literacy classes, but that I believe that there is a level of media literacy out there that, you know, when you see something on film, that you know that it involves actors. I thought that the story of the porn literacy, like the things that I found most encouraging were twofold. First, that when these kids learned more about the porn industry, it really affected their view of porn and really kind of drove home that this is a business. This isn't like, you know, this isn't a YouTube video of people, you know, real people doing real things. This is an acting scenario that's made for money, that's, you know, where the things that happen are done because they're the things that, you know, make most money. And also that when kids had sex, they compared what the things that went on in the porn were like to what it felt like to be, you know, in their own bodies with someone else in a similar situation, and said, you know, just fully clearly, that was nothing like what happened in the porn. Like, this is like that it's not real life. And I found that very comforting. But I also do find I do worry too.
Yeah, I'm with June in that I think these kids are advanced in ways we can't even understand. They basically all are born with like a PhD in media studies. On the other hand, they have super young brains, and images are powerful. And it's like quite a cavalcade of imagery that they're getting, you know, flash before them all the time. But Hannah, you have teenagers. So how do you feel?
I do. The story, which I want to say is by Maggie Jones, because I think she did an amazing job of just kind of getting to a different truth than a lot of people get to with this subject. Well, here, first of all, I felt two ways about that thing you mentioned, June, about, you know, this education telling you that this is an industry. I felt that was an interesting way to go about it because it put distance between you and the thing that you were watching. It was also a bit of a literal-minded way to go about it. I'm not sure that the intellectual can override the visceral and emotional that way, that like just knowing in your head, it's like saying, well, the death penalty is a deterrent. It's like knowing in your head that something is true is not necessarily going to erase the kind of feeling that you have and the images that get implanted in your head when you watch the thing. Mm-hmm. And I also think they're smarter than the people teaching the class probably, and they know that that's not true. I mean, amateur porn is like must be a quarter of porn on Pornhub these days. It's not all like, you know, slaves from the Ukraine being forced to act out porn acts. Like, it's not all, you can't really portray it entirely as this kind of a crude exploitative business. Here's what my friend Mary and I discussed. The issue is, so a lot of times sex was a bit of a blank, like generationally. It's like you just didn't have that much information. You had to pick up bits and pieces information. Like I can remember all the bits and pieces like from my teacher in school or from what I overheard adults saying and from like little sneak peeks that I got at books or movies or, you know, walking down 42nd Street one, you know, a bunch of times when I was an intern there, like not on the street. I was an intern in an actual place on 42nd Street, but that's that sounded funny.
Like, is it a
to be an intern at 42nd Street? It just sounded all wrong. But anyway, I walked down 42nd Street a lot when I was a teenager. So
that's you know, worse. You just did,
that's not, sorry. Everything I say about 42nd Street sounds bad. But you, the point was like I did not have full information, and so like I kind of had to stumble my way through it with other guys who are also teenagers and kind of had to figure out along the way what it was. But like right now, the thing that's operating is a kind of glut of information and a totally false confidence that that information gives. And so there isn't any space for like, I don't know, you know, both yeah. in its kind of awe and its human experimentation. It's like, yeah, I know this is how it works. Looks like this, you know, yeah. and you're kind of young. So it does kind of look like that in the pictures. And I wonder, like, then you have to do the work of like unknowing and re-knowing. And that just seems like a lot of work. You know?
Yeah. And people don't do that work, right? Exactly. Like, not to bring up our friend Aziz Ansari or our not friend Aziz Ansari, but like, you know, one of the comments that people made about the description of that encounter that he had was that it was so porn inflected and so sort of dehumanized. Like, this was just a person who was there and they could do some things, right? And the thing about that stumbling with another person when you don't actually know what you're doing is you actually have to listen and figure out how that other person is reacting to things and like think about them as a holistic human being, not just a set of parts, right? And that's like, that's a good sex education, I think.
Yeah, I mean, well, you say the word sex education, and unfortunately that's something that's rarer and rarer. And, you know, we may live in places where it does exist. There are obviously states that do decent sex education, but in vast swaths of the country, there is either non or actively false education, which it defies the word. And so that false confidence is all the more worrying because of the lack of kind of, I don't even know what about truth. That seems like a hard word to define in this context. I mean, there kind of should be some mystery around sex. Like it always will be something that you're more driven by curiosity than like a factual, you know, I've got a fact base here. I've got my notes that I've made in my notebook. You know, like it's always going to be this like urges and curiosity and just wanting to figure things out. But clearly there are these big gaps that everything's a little odd in this context. But there are areas where there just are things that kids are not told. And so, yeah, they're smart and they do have this amazing literacy, but it's just depressing to me that the thing that is available to them most easily is porn. Like, well, that should not be so.
Even in that class in the Maggie Jones article, this totally progressive, like, let's analyze porn critically, there's a moment where one of the teachers starts to tell them about, like, you know, what are the ways, like, what are the actual anatomical ways a woman actually experiences pleasure? And the other teacher steers her away because they can't talk about that, right? Like, so even in this super progressive sex education, it can't be sort of instructive in that way. It has to be, like, clinical and at a remove. And that to me seems like the problem.
Yeah.
And
oh, that's like the only conversation they should have. You know?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. The problem with porn is not that it's like, you know, necessarily, well, there's many, so many conversations I want to have. But the problem with porn is that it and this amazes me in 2018 that porn still looks like this. Like its attention to female pleasure is almost zero. And I don't understand why. Like, I don't understand why porn has not changed at all. Everything else has changed and sort of moved forward. But porn is exactly the same in its understanding of what women are. It has remained at a total standstill. And I don't know why. Like, I'm sure that there are women who are watching porn even amateur porn. I mean, there's, you know, like you can find porn that's about women's pleasure, but you really have to dig hard. Most of it is entirely from a man's point of view, has an entirely fake and unrealistic sense of the woman having fun. Like, why? That's just, why is it still like that?
So this was my gut reaction to Ross Douthat's article, Let's Ban Porn, I think was the actual title. And he tries to make the argument that, like, you know, feminists should get on board with this, that porn is harmful and that banning it is the only answer. And it seemed to me that, like, really took the conversation in a place it didn't need to go. It just seems like, why don't we fix it, right? Like, you can't put it, you can't, you know, stuff it back in
stuff that there.
God, I'm amazed that's our first one.
Like, well, we had some holes.
We had gaps and holes too. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, you can't turn back time. Is what I'll say. But you can, like, maybe try to change what is actually on screen. And I understand fully that there are people trying to do that. I feel like I get a pitch from a freelancer about Cindy Gallup once a month, once a week, all the time, that there is feminist porn happening. But, like, and I know that that might be a Sisyphean task, that the quantity of it in the world is so, like, large. But that seems to me to be a more constructive thing rather than, like, sort of trying to change, you know, First Amendment laws and like wrestle with the internet in that way. The real
but
feminist...
I feel like that's a little facile. Like, can we just put, can I push a little hard?
Yeah,
like,
sure.
I do not think we should ban porn because I just, there's a million reasons why I don't think so. But I do feel like Ross has us, like, he has us pinned to the wall that, like, that we want it all. Porn doesn't change. It's like, no matter what we do, and I totally agree with you, every time I make this argument, somebody brings up Cindy Gallup. Like, somebody brings up the one single, like, woman-run porn thing, you know? It doesn't change for some reason. And we have set ourselves, like, in our conversation with Me Too, we've set ourselves forward. Like, people understand that, like, certain things don't fly, like the Aziz Ansari moment. But porn is, like, really 10 steps back. It's 10 steps back in figuring, well, this female pleasure thing out.
It's about capitalism, right? I mean, even though, you know, we're especially the sort of porn that was talked about in Maggie Jones' article, is the vast quantities of porn that's available for free. So stuff that Cindy Gallup makes and, you know, feminist porn and conscious porn, all of that stuff, that's not free because that's about, you know, paying people and having good processes, and that's not going to be free porn, and free porn is what's going to be consumed. And I honestly don't understand the business model of free porn. But I presume that somehow dudes are paying for it, and so dudes get what dudes want. I mean, more men are likely to get out their credit cards, I guess, at some point in the process. I'm afraid my awareness of porn is quite low.
That's what depresses me ultimately, is that, like, if the market demand is there for, like, really sort of, you know, stuff that degrades women. Although I'm not sure. I don't know. It just might be a, like, this is out there, so then it's what people think they want kind of thing. I mean, to me, the like, if feminists take as their cause, even not in the extreme version that Ross is talking about, you know, the idea of banning porn, that essentially, I think, stigmatizes sex in a way that would really, I think, set the cultural conversation back and you know, reinforce the idea that it's somehow dirty and not okay. And I think that impulse that it's dirty and shameful is where some of this darker kind of porn comes from. And so that just doesn't seem like the solution to me, just as a way of progressing the cultural script. Although I do, I mean, I acknowledge that Ross's central tenet that, like, actually the thing that feminists and women are not saying here is that we're upset by it, like, on some level.
I think you're right that does set the conversation back, because our squeamishness around sex is part of the problem. And so that, just having that, like, writing that up on your sign in a woman's march, I think sends off the wrong message. but if you think of the central problem that the kind of porn that exists now for free creates, is a normalization of a certain kind of sex, which isn't, in fact, normal in the actual bedroom. I don't mean, like, normal. I'm not saying, like, anal sex is terrible. I don't think that's true. I think there's lots of theories. Oh, my God. How am I forgetting his name at Slate, who wrote the greatest series about anal sex?
Will Salatin.
Will Salatin once wrote a great series last time the sex survey came out about all our assumptions about anal sex and whether women do or do not like it. This was a few years ago, and how we make these kind of sexist assumptions about that and all the proof around that. And it was really, really interesting. So it's not that, but it's the norms. It makes people think that certain things are true that aren't true, and it norms a kind of behavior around sex and violence which people don't understand, like might be a certain kind of fantasy or might be a men's fantasy, but is not something that actually translates necessarily into an actual experience, or they don't understand how it might translate into an actual experience with an actual woman. So I don't know. I mean, it felt to me like porn education was like these YouTube, by the way, we haven't mentioned this, but like the one actually successful pushback against this are the various sex ed YouTube stars like Lacey Green and all of that, who actually do talk about porn. They talk about kissing. They teach you how to do all kinds of things. They talk about every kind of sex and a lot of them are women, and they talk about it in a way. So that's always like where I put my flag, is like there is a revolt against it. Not a revolt against this, but there is another sort of online vertical that challenges the porn that people do tune into and really like.
Totally. And you know, part of Ross's argument, part that I listened to him on the Slate's Political Gabfest, and he was sort of saying, a little bit in jest but also not, that evangelicals have given up the moral crusading flag, right? You know, when they backed Mr. Trump, who talked about in our first segment with all his morality, they sort of, you know, gave it up, and feminists are, you know, we are inheriting the mantle of the moral crusaders of our time, and so he wants to push feminists to do this kind of thing. And I would say that, like, we should stay strong and not be reactionary, not, you know, and like push toward enlightenment, push toward, you know, YouTube instructional videos, not the banning porn kind of impulse. But the last thing that I want to say is that, you know, there is all this literature out there that indicates that young people are having less sex than ever, right? So some of the fears that people originally had about porn was that it would, you know, exposure to it would increase the risk of risky behavior. And I think the jury's a little bit out on that, but overall, like the direct cause effect, but overall, teens and even young adults are engaging in less risky sex, but also less sex overall. And it's really impossible to isolate that kind of thing. But I do think, just on a gut level, that like if you are a teenager who like hasn't figured out your own body, much less someone else's, and this is your image of what sex is, and it's like totally like every sort of fetishistic version of sex that is possible is available to you, you might be a little scared of it. You might be even more scared than a normal teenager might be. And
oh my God, the amount of just kind of like performativeness around sex without the actual, you know, tentative experience of sex in teenage life is amazing. Like, not just the existence of porn, not just our kind of open discussions about sex now. Like, you know, the culture talks about sex. There's New York Times Magazine articles. We are in some ways kind of, you know, there's more acceptance of talk of sex in the public sphere. But the way teenagers dress now, which is not the way teenagers, that was not the norm of teenager dress when I was a teenager, is amazing. So you have all this kind of performance of sex without any actual sex, which is this current situation that teenagers are in, as far as I can tell. It's weird. Well, listeners, if you have any experiences with your teenagers and porn, any thoughts to share, just any particular experiences which have enlightened you about the situation, please share them with us, either on our Facebook page for XX Gabfest, or you can write at XXGabFest@slate.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, our next topic, Lena Dunham. I am self-conscious about this topic. Noreen has made me self-conscious about this topic, but let's talk about our self-consciousness. Let me just say what we're talking about first before I make lots of qualifications, because I've already made 20. All right, in a recent issue of Vogue,
you sound like Lena Dunham.
I know. And she wrote about her decision to have a hysterectomy after she suffered crippling pain from endometriosis. For a 31-year-old, for anybody, really, it's an unusual medical decision. It means she won't be having children, for one thing, but it's just an unusual medical decision in response to the pain she was feeling. But she does not feel any ambivalence about it. She wrote, "I know it as intensely as I know I want a baby, that something is wrong with my uterus. I can feel it, deeply specific yet unverified, despite so many tests and so much medical dialogue. I just sense that the uterus I have been given is defective." So, yes, Lena Dunham did choose to write a story about it. She has been very public about it, or somewhat public about it, probably not about every twist and turn of her pain and suffering. And yet there's something that feels wrong about discussing it. And I kind of want to start there so I'm not just self-conscious for the entire length of the discussion. And I think that will lead us to an interesting place. So, Noreen, can you just articulate what your resistance was to even raising this topic?
I think it's inherently difficult to talk about another woman's, I mean, it's not difficult. It's very easy to talk about another woman's choices, right? It's something that I resist, right? Like, particularly her reproductive choices, right? If it were her decision to have an abortion, many of the people who have sort of, you know, questioned whether this was a decision she should have made would not question that decision, right? If it were her decision to, you know, have a baby with IVF, any number of other reproductive choices, people probably wouldn't have questioned. But this one, the decision to sort of cut off an avenue of reproduction, you know, people are very happy to send. So I guess my resistance is like, I'm not in her body, right? I don't know what was going on. You know, women's pain, particularly gynecological pain, is underdiagnosed, underlistened to. That was my sort of resistance.
And the fact that it's her too, right?
Yeah.
That it's like Lena Dunham, you just say the name and a whole bunch of people like have a response before you even say what it is you're going to talk about her. And I think the fact, it only Lena Dunham could have gotten this response to this piece, not only because she's famous, but because we're all so, you know, we all have opinions about her body in a sense and about her relationship with her body.
And her choices.
Yeah, and
right?
Her choices, yeah. Yes. I think there are a lot of reasons that if this was like by, you know, Jane Doe, it wouldn't have gotten this response. But I do think that it's really interesting as something that happened in our world.
Mm-hmm. And she wrote about it very eloquently. And, you know, it's not something that you see people writing about a lot. It also tracks particularly interestingly with the end of Girls, where the Hannah Horvath character sort of becomes an adult by becoming a mother, right? I couldn't get that out of my head as I was reading her talking about motherhood and her choice to sort of, not her choice to have her uterus moved.
Yeah, it's, you know, since you made me self-conscious about this topic, I've just been self-policing, and it's been a really like kind of neurotic conversation I'm having in my head, because on the one hand, I feel like she could not have created a situation that was more Lena Dunham than this situation, even though it's the real Lena Dunham, because it's a situation that she's, you know, since she was in college, like just kind of put her body out there and then follow her own logic so particularly. I mean, she's very honest about the fact that the doctors did not recommend this as a solution to her pain, that this is not, she's an outlier, you know? Outlier is different from saying like she doesn't know what she's talking about,
right,
or anything like that.
Right.
It's just that she is a medical outlier. Like, this is not what you would find as a medical recommendation for this particular problem. So she's following her own logic, as she always does, involving her body. She's doing it publicly in Vogue magazine. So she's doing it publicly. This is not private, you know, in a sense. She's sort of chosen to write a first person story about it. And again, it's like it's like what she's always done. So there's a part of me that has to tamp down, like, is she challenging me? Like, is this a challenge to the culture? Like, go ahead and judge the decision I've made, not just to make some take a decision that the doctors have not recommended I take with my body, but that's a radical decision. And that is going to foreclose the option of what all of you think women should do, which is having a baby. And yet everything I just said is like not the proper response to have to this situation, because it's not girls and it's not a public kind of, you know, art project she's doing. It's a totally personal medical decision. So anyway, that's my whole neurotic thing that I've been having.
There's also a complicated relationship with privilege that has always, again, has always been around Lena Dunham and has always been contested. How much privilege does she have? How much is she aware of it? And I think this piece proved perhaps that she is very aware of her privilege and doesn't hide it in the way that some people do. You know, where there's that whole bit where she talks about checking into the hospital and refusing to leave until the pain was gone, which is like, good luck with that if you don't have either a magnificent health insurance policy or more likely a really good bank account. Because, like, again, that is just not an option that's available to women. So it's not just about her, like, determination. It's about the fact that she was able to do something that simply isn't available to, you know, pretty much everybody else.
Did you feel like there was a lot of cultural judgment around the baby thing? I actually was surprised at how muted that was and kind of heartened by how muted that was, you know, that people did not necessarily treat her as a pariah. It felt like a move forward to me for a woman to make it just like foreclose the option of having children and the culture not to die.
Yeah, I mean, I did. There was an interview in The Cut with a gynecologist who specializes in endometriosis who was a little bit, I would say, judgmental. I had some conversations with people offline where they sort of expressed a little shock, not so much at cutting herself off from the idea of children. I mean, she did not have a radical or a total, I'm going to get the terminology a little wrong, but she did not have her ovaries removed. There are ways that she could have children, she could adopt. She said that it's something that's super important to her. But I think the place where people are going to sit in judgment and, you know, the way that she writes it sort of opens it up to that is the rashness of the decision almost. And it's not entirely rash. She obviously was living with pain for years and years and years. And she describes a really protracted period of pain leading up to this. But the doctor told her, let's wait and see. And she sort of jokes, oh, 2 days was enough for me. Like, that's, you know, that's my version of wait and see. And, you know, having your reproductive organs removed doesn't just affect your ability to have a baby, it affects all kinds of other functions in your body. You know, like a lot of the hormonally driven things that happen in your body, which is more than you might think, are changed by this. And so it is a really big decision. Right. The culture didn't explode. I think that's great, actually. Like, I've been thinking more and more. I'm in my 30s and I've been thinking more and more about how, like, you know, in literature, you talk about the marriage plot, right? Like, as a sort of, you know, that's how the novel goes, right? And I think in your 30s, it's actually like the fertility plot, right? Mm. Like, it's like a race to this certain kind of thing before this end date, in the way that in the 19th century, it was before your sell-by date. And what she's doing is she's kind of disrupting the fertility plot in an interesting way, in a way that she didn't do on her show, you know, but in her real life, she's doing that. So I'm interested in that version of it.
It's funny. I, as somebody who just never wanted kids, I'm a little bit less kind of alive to that whole aspect of this. To me, the thing that is what the story is about is her challenging the medical establishment. Mm. And it's because, yes, when these various stories that ask physicians, oh, what do you think about this thing that she did? They talk about it as if, like, that's really not recommended. And so she's challenging recommendations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I've been very interested in the way that there's been a somewhat muted sort of expression of, oh, does she really know what she's doing? You know, which obviously can be, and in its motivation is a kind of condescending, she doesn't know, it's dismissive. Rather than when really, again, it could be modeling a way of like, I've done my research. I know. And I really have made this decision that this, you know, as we've said, this is my body. I've gone through, I think she said this, that the hysterectomy was her 9th surgical procedure to try to, you know, cure or alleviate this endometriosis. And that to me is what really kind of called out in the story that you can, you know, what a person, again, who has money can do, even when physicians say, I don't know if that's the best thing. I don't know. It's right. Clearly they didn't say, no, you shouldn't, you can't, we won't. But she was really pushing beyond what they wanted to do.
Right. Right.
That's a really good point. I felt totally triumphant about that, too, that kind of our bodies, ourselves sort of return to an intuitive notion, which the doctors never meet with what they should meet, which is like, well, actually, we don't know. We have no idea where her pain is coming from. Like, yeah. It could be this. We just don't know. You know, there are all these outliers. And instead, they're like, well, it's not medically recommended. You know, yeah. Sure. But you actually don't know where it's coming from. Like, this is one of those cases where it's often a woman comes to face-to-face with the medical establishment, and there's an air of sort of like you're crazy around it, and an inability of doctors to just like take the humble path and say, I don't know, it's a mystery, something's going on, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, it was interesting that several of the stories, made a comparison or brought up the case of Angelina Jolie, who wrote, you know, two different New York Times op-eds about her decision to have a mastectomy and then also to have her uterus and ovaries removed. And that was around cancer risk. That was around the BRCA1 gene. And that at this point is not exactly medically recommended, but, you know, not that far away from it for women who make that decision. You know, that's presented as a choice. Like we will give you these statistics about 95%. You can bring it down to 5%. Those were not the actual numbers. And so that is slightly different. But a few years ago, I think we would have and were like much more freaked out by those kinds of choices that women are making.
Although people responded, I think overall, like completely warmly towards Angelina Jolie's decision, because like with cancer, it's your life at risk, right? And with something like endometriosis, it's pain, right? Mm-hmm. And even though pain can be so all consuming and like just take over your entire body and brain, that's still like your life's not at risk. So people see that as a different calculus. Even though like pain management, I feel like it's the biggest problem in medicine and
causing huge crisis, social and criminal justice problems.
Yeah, of course. But it's also true. I know this from, you know, my own, like I just remember once I had an ear infection. I was like, I just want to cut my fucking ear off, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So I do understand that impulse, but it is true that I think that's another reason why the impulse to judge is so easy here, because you're like, well, you're just making that decision because you're in pain. Like I've been there, you know, but again, I'm not in her body. None of us are in her body or her life, so we don't know.
And, you know, I once worked with somebody at a feminist or, you know, a feminist business that was all women. And one of my colleagues had just terrible chronic endometriosis and, you know, was effectively out of business for several days a month. And I always wondered, like, if she hadn't been at a feminist business, if there hadn't been an all-woman workplace, would she have been able to, you know, be honest about what was going on with her body? I mean, because she still had to get her work done. It wasn't like she was getting time off, you know what I mean? But it was, she was able to work around her pain and the absolute debilitating, you know, she could barely move. And that, I wonder how much that is recognized in, you know, the vast majority of workplaces, which are not women-only workplaces.
Yeah, I think it's cool she's talking about it. She actually wrote an essay for Glamour that didn't get as much attention in the fall before she had her surgery, about how whenever she talks about endometriosis, the first thing people ask her about is fertility and what she plans to do about children and how it's going to affect that. And then they gave her all kinds of unsolicited advice. And, you know, it's interesting that essay didn't get the same kind of attention. Obviously, it was at a different stage in the process. But so I think it's like good that she's opening up the conversation.
All right. I think we've done a decent and respectful job of discussing this.
If
I hope.
We do say so ourselves.
You listeners. If we do say so ourselves, you listeners can be the judge.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. June, what do you have for us?
Before I get to my recommendation, I just want to put in a word for one of the other Slate podcasts. It's one to which we have some connections. It is the Political Gabfest. Stephen Colbert says everyone should listen to this Slate Culture Gabfest, and who are we to argue? It's very smart, and the hosts, several of whom have close ties to the XX Gabfest, one of our founding podcasters, Emily Bazelon, Hannah's partner in Love and Life, David Plotz, and newly installed CBS This Morning co-host John Dickerson, push each other to defend and explain the ideas they offer. They don't just nod along with one another in an ever-repeating echo chamber. Who would do that? The Political Gabfest also gets into the legal and philosophical dimensions of politics. And from time to time, they debate important topics like, is it better to be a dragon or a unicorn? You can check it out every Thursday evening. For my actual recommendation, I want to put in a really good word for a book. This may seem like log rolling because it's written by a Slate staffer and someone who's very much in the Slate orbit. It is the book The World Only Spins Forward, The Ascent of Angels in America, which is by Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce. And it's an oral history of Tony Kushner's play and the struggle to, you know, make it happen and then to, you know, what happened as it made its journey around America and then around the world. And I have to say, you know, this is a weird confession, but I've been having a really hard time reading recently as somebody who's always been like a reader was, you know, how I separated myself when I was a little kid. I read early, I read a lot, and I've just been having a hard time reading of late. And this was a book that was one of my first like returns to reading because it's such an interesting and such a, you know, it kind of pulls you in because it is an oral history and you hear from, you know, from a lot of actors and from Tony Kushner and from people involved in the theaters where the play was trying to be presented. So it's a really, it's just such a page turner. So I really recommend The World Only Spins Forward.
And I second both of your recommendations. It is a great book and my husband is awesome. both of those things are true. So I'm on board. Dan, it is a great book, by the way. Okay, so my recommendation is also a book, This Could Hurt by Jillian Medoff. It's such a good book. It's a book about the HR department of a company which you don't really even know what they do, called Ellery. And it is about so much more. It's just about all the relationships between people in the HR department, their growing intimacy with each other, and all the dysfunction and all the friendship and love. It is the best book about office life. I feel like office life has so much rich material now that I work in an office again. And this is the best book about office life that I have read. It's really great.
Hannah, your husband also recommended that in glowing terms on his podcast.
He did?
Yes. And I put it in my Amazon, you know, wish list compendium because of that. And it's just funny to watch the book circulate in the Rosenplatz household. But a double recommendation.
Well, you know,
now I'll do it.
you know what the real truth is, actually, about all of these things? They start with my daughter.
Oh.
She reads them and then she gives them to David, and then Dave, it's like comes filtered down to me, and I only get some of them because those two have very similar reading tastes, but they know that I won't like most of what they read. Huh. They tend slightly trashier than I do.
I need their reading recommendations.
Yeah, I know.
To get me back on track.
Real interested. I like a trashy read, you know?
Oh, Noah's the cheap. My daughter, I mean, she could give you like 47 pages of every sort of slightly, not like really, not really trashy, like at the Gone Girl level, you know, for the last 10 years.
Cool. Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
My recommendation is streaming on Netflix. It's an old movie. I finally watched Paris is Burning, which is a documentary film about sort of very late 1980s New York, the I guess you could say the drag ball scene, but it's these balls in Harlem where you get to see what drag was like then, but it's also really about obviously, you know, what it's like, what it was like to be gay in New York in the 80s during the AIDS crisis. It's like to be Black or a minority and to be gay, to be trans. There are some people in it who are trans. It's like funny, it's affecting, it's sharp, it's really sad at points. And you see how much of like our current culture borrows from that, what was a subculture and how that's bled through. It was just, and it's like beautifully shot and done and like really fun to watch. And I couldn't recommend it more.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
It's just like all the sisterhood on the recommendations today.
Cool.
All right. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Verilyn Williams, who just jumped in and did a shout-out for Black Panther, which we're all going to see this week. Our production assistant is Daniel Schrader. Listeners, go and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. Leave a review so other people can find out about the show. Tell your friends about it. We would greatly appreciate it. That's our show for today. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen.